up on episode number 30 of the Inside Running Podcast. Thanks for joining us again. Episode 30, boys, starting to grow up a bit, hitting my age, actually. Thanks for joining me again. Thanks to runnerstribe.com for sponsoring this week's show. Always love the content they're putting out over there. Welcome, Bradley and Julian.
Good evening, Brady.
Good to be here, mate.
Good to be here. Good to have you here. We just had our biggest off-air meeting before a show, so hopefully it turns into a good quality show, this one, because we've actually put a bit of planning into it.
Sort of.
Wasn't there like three moose on the looses just in the chat?
That'll be the bonus episode for this week if you recorded it.
I didn't record it, but I should have. I think Brad always records everything, so you got to watch out when you're talking to him. Julian's a week off Great Ocean Road Marathon. How's the body come down from the big highs of last week?
You come off pretty hard, mate, to be honest. I don't know whether anyone else gets this, but the week after a marathon, doesn't even matter if you went good. I'm sure it'll be worse if you went poorly, but you just go into like this kind of blue, like run the post-marathon blues are real. They're a reality, and they've set in all week for me. So all I could think about was getting back to running and not having a daily chore to do. So I'd wake up. I took a week off running. I was supposed to – even today, mate, I couldn't even get out today. I'm just not myself. Did catch up on a lot of work, though. It's amazing how much – when you stop running, how much other stuff you could do. I could probably be a successful business owner, I reckon, if I didn't run.
You are a successful business owner, aren't you?
No, I'm just a business owner at the moment, but I could be successful, I reckon, if I stopped exercising.
So you go through that blues even when you win. I've never won
a marathon before. Yeah, I know. It's bloody weird. Because you have to put your application in for prize money, it's not like I can just bathe in my cash. So it's I'm coming off the marathon with sore quads, sore calves, and just a real hangover, to be honest. It probably doesn't help you go out on the piss afterwards, because I get hangover for like 3 days and the body feels gross, like sick in the guts, headaches. I'm just describing a hangover, but that's what I was feeling. Plus add sore quads, sore back, and calves that you can't even really bend at the ankle at all. They're so tight and sore. Takes a while to get back moving, and my body felt good Friday. Felt like I could probably have a jog, but I didn't. I made a pact with myself, 7 days of no running, and that's now turned into 8, which is good. I put today off. I went and did a bit of lumberjacking in the forest, get some firewood, and when I got back, I was so stuffed I couldn't even get my 20-minute jog out. So yeah, right. The road to Berlin is starting a day late.
Yeah. Talk us about applying for prize money. A lot of people wouldn't know you have to do that.
Oh, well, I guess big companies like IMG that dish out cash, they're essentially paying a supplier. So you're a supplier, and it's very business-like. But if I was a professional sportsman and prize money was my source of income, I would get taxed on it. So I have to give them an invoice in that case if I was registered for GST. But I'm not. So us runners that don't do it for money, we do it for the love. We can claim prize money as a hobby. There's a few other sort of tax breaks where you wouldn't have to provide an APN for. So you don't actually apply for it. You just have to return the statement by supplier as not being registered for GST or not being an ABN holder for this type of prize money. And then it goes through their normal pace. Like, this is a massive company, IMG, worldwide company. They do events all over the world. Like the race director, Marcus Gale, he's a Melbourne Marathon director. And I think he's even directed the Australian Masters golf tournament. Maybe 2009 or something. Like, he's a big player. So it's a big company.
Yeah, very good. How's the plantar fasciitis in the calf?
It's interesting after a race like this, because you're so sore, you don't really know how your actual injuries are until everything else, all the general soreness goes. and what's lingering is an injury. So I'm 7-8 days out now, and plantar is still, it's okay. I mean, it's certainly runnable, and the calf seems fine. So I'm over the calf injury. It's just how the plantar goes with the load of training for a marathon. We'll have to wait and see.
Hmm. Yeah. Any other news for us? What else have you been doing this week?
Oh, so much work, mate. So much work. Been getting this podcast ready to go.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Run the gap.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about that.
The gap. Yep. So it's an awesome trail run. Like, if you don't get to the Grampians, or if you don't go there once a year, it's not enough. The Grampians are amazing. They are one of the coolest places that I've ever been, and they're only 2.5 hours from Melbourne, 1.5 hours from Ballarat, and just the setting. You're basically Halls Gap, Dunkeld, these amazing little towns with mountain views, surrounded by mountains. Run the Gap's one of the trail runs down there, and it's a 6K, 12K, or 21K. We were down there sponsoring the event. Super race. I want to do it. It's always a week after Gradation Road, so it's a bit tough there. But it's a to-do list race. Like, great atmosphere down there, cool local community that support it, all run by locals. And when we rocked up, we recognised heaps of people from Ballarat, Geelong, Surf Coast, up at the river, Bendigo. It's well received.
Mm. Pretty good event down there as well, like good numbers and stuff. Who won it? Give us a bit of a recap.
Yeah, okay. Oh, you put me on the spot. So I know the male winner was Michael Kernahan. He is a runner from Mentone. Very famous in the Strava world, Kerners is. Likes to chase a course record, King of the Mountain or two.
I'll be bringing him up a bit later on in my weekly recap.
Were you? Okay. Well, yeah. There you go.
He got the win.
He did. So he went out hard. And apparently the second pack, there are a few little jokes made about how he's going to come back to them all later on. And one bloke, Dom Godfrey in the second pack said, "No boys, he's out. He's away for the day. Don't even bother." And he was. So he ran, I think he ran around 132, 133 or something, which is pretty good on that course. Goes up a very big hill, trail run. Ladies winner, oh, geez, I can't pick her, but she's a local lady. I think she's a doctor. She does stair climbing, so good on the hills. She came first in the 21K. I haven't done my research here because you put me on the spot.
I put you on the spot. But more even just tell us about, like, when you're working that and sponsoring the event. So, like, are you just selling shoes off to the side, or are you marking courses, or what does that look like for you?
Oh, yep. So what were we doing? We were a late call-up for the sponsorship, so we didn't do that much pre-event promo stuff. We tried to do as much as we could to get people involved, like spread a bit of the love in Ballarat. And then when we went down Saturday night, set up early Sunday morning, we were creating an atmosphere or presence at the end. So we've got the big van set up. We've got two big marquees we set up outside, but we only set one up actually in this one because it was such good weather. Tables of cool trail gear, trail shoes, packs, waterproof jackets, headlamps, sealer beanies and running caps, that kind of business. Steigen socks we had down there. So we create a little bit of a buzz in that manner. Like, people come and have a chat. We recognize everyone, provide a bit of atmosphere at the finish line. Yeah, we don't like, from the running company perspective, our goal's not down there to sell a bunch of stuff. Our goal's there to meet people, talk about their shoes, build relationships. So when they do think of getting shoes, they think, oh, we'll go see Julian or we'll go see Bree up in Ballarat. So we're there to build relationships, basically. And it was a really good event for that. Heaps of cool people, and we met heaps of, like, rural people. But our store I won't go too much into it, but we do a lot of the rural areas because there's very limited places to get good running advice or shoe advice or gear advice or whatever. So we have people travel to Ballarat from the surrounding cities, and there was a lot there at Halls Gap.
Alice McNamara was the lady who won the females.
Yeah, good on you. And she's just, I know she's, I got a bit of background stare on her. I think she's won that, what's that one, big one up in Melbourne?
Eureka what's Tower.
The Eureka. Apparently she's won that before.
Good. Hurry up. You haven't got much to report.
I think she might have been an elite rower too.
How'd you pull that one?
Because I used to work at the AIS.
Oh, yeah.
Haven't you heard that story before?
You haven't heard that before.
Yeah, it's a bit like Chico, isn't it?
Used to work with Kate Smythe at the AIS.
Oh yeah. Who's that? Brad who?
Never heard
Matthew Delvedover. Matthew Delvedover, actually.
He was emptying bins, I reckon, out the back.
Yeah, he was in the kitchen
chopping carrots in the kitchen. Alright, yeah, Brad, tell us about your week. Big week before a half marathon.
Yeah, so I had a pretty good week.
Pretty good understatement. Run. This is a huge week. Anyway, sorry, keep going.
Yeah, so because I ran pretty solid on the Sunday, I didn't do a session till the Wednesday. So Monday just got out for an hour in the morning, and like all of my easy runs have been like super quick the last couple of weeks. Like I haven't been forcing them, but I'm sort of surprised at how quick they've been. So it was like 4:05 per kilometre Monday morning, 4:01s in the afternoon for 45 minutes. And then Tuesday morning was like 4:09s for an hour, and then had a sort of staff meeting Tuesday arvo, so got out after that for 35 minutes and did some strides. That was 4:05s. Then my first session for the week was Wednesday morning, and it was 5x1K off a 90-second jog just on the bike path around Yerribee, and probably the best I've ever done Ks, especially off away from the track. So I averaged 2:51 per kilometre off 90 seconds. So close. I think my last rep was 48. So I was pretty stoked with that.
What did you go in there trying to do? Like what was the coach's instructions that session?
I guess similar to what I've been doing in the lead up to like Sydney 10. So Sydney 10, I was like, he doesn't really put a pace on it. It's more a feel, and don't like run hard, but don't, you know, give it absolutely everything. And so I would have been putting in the same effort as I was before Sydney 10, but before Sydney 10, I was running say 2:55s, and I was running 2:51s this time around. So, and even the recoveries, I was sort of, you know, rolling at sort of 4:30 per kilometre pace, and nothing, it's not a float, but it's not standing around like hands on knees either, you know, if you're doing that. So that was Wednesday morning. Then Wednesday afternoon, just got out for 35 minutes at 4:11s. Because I did a session on Wednesday, I pushed my midweek long run back to the Thursday and felt amazing again. Ran for an hour 45, got 27K done, which averaged 3:54s, close to 400 metres of elevation. So just the one run on the Thursday. Friday was an hour in the morning, 4:11s. Friday afternoon, 35 minutes at 3:58, followed by 6 10-second hills. And then my session for Saturday was 2x6K off a 2-minute float. So I ran 18:49 for the first 6K, which I think is about 3:08s. Floated 2 minutes at 3:30 kilometre pace, and then ran 18:26 for the second 6K, which was like 3:04s. So averaged 3:07s for the 12.5K. So only one run Saturday, and then Sunday was 2:15, which was 33.5K at 4:01s, which had about 400 metres of elevation for a week of 182 kilometres. So body feels good. Sessions were good. I've never felt this good running across the ground before ever. So if I could bottle the feeling that I get every time I go for a run at the moment, it's an amazing feeling. So hopefully it converts to a half-decent race in New Zealand.
Wow.
Yeah, I am so impressed with this week. 182, though, the week before a major race. Like, is that planned or you just Kay's got away from you?
No, but it's not a major – like, the coach and I, we haven't actually targeted any races. It's not – like, same with Sydney 10. It was – we only decided about 10 days out from Sydney 10 that I was going to do it. It's more just find something to do to break up training. So I'm not actually focusing on the racing. It's just something to do. So I'll have an easier week this week. And then obviously off the back of the half, I'll have an easy week and sort of just reset and then go into another block before Gold Coast and then have a break after that and then go into another block. So I'm really thinking long term at the moment with another marathon like down the track and just trying to get stronger and stronger and stronger. But yeah, the races aren't the focus at the moment. So if I race well, great, but it's not the focus. Yeah.
That would be difficult for me to do, to go out and do all these Ks and all these great sessions, fantastic sessions, without having something that I'm just constantly working towards.
Yeah, well, as I said, the feeling I get when I run at the moment, like it's just so enjoyable. And yes, I ran 182K last week, but I'm not tired. Like I feel fresh. Like if I had to race the half tomorrow, I'd be confident that I'd run okay based on how I feel.
Yeah. So, but I mean, what are you doing?
Why do you feel so
No, I want to know what Croak is doing this year.
Send a bit of this down to a Chukumo Emma.
Well, we haven't actually discussed. Well, I want to run another marathon. We haven't decided yet. Leaning towards Fukuoka. But I don't know. I'll try and find a race once a month to do, but
I reckon pick one sooner.
Meh.
Well, I reckon sooner. I reckon September.
Because I got a baby born in September.
I reckon you need to get it out before the baby.
Exactly. Jesus. August, September.
Well, yeah, so what am I going to find in August?
Oh, something. There's a gold label race every weekend on, isn't there, in the world? You'll find something.
You've got plenty of money.
Go around the Vietnam Marathon or something.
No.
You'd go to Scandinavia. It has some races, I think. What about America?
Yeah. No. Go run a rock and roll series and win one over there.
Nah. I'll just keep the powder dry a bit longer.
You're going to burn out if you don't do a race.
Well, I'm racing. I'm racing this weekend.
Yeah, but, you know, like, you'll mentally burn out.
No, I disagree. Like, I'm like 182 last week. It didn't even feel like a hard week.
That doesn't matter. It's about having something to work towards.
Once a month. I went Sydney 10, and then that gave me confidence, and it's sort of taken me up. Like, so the race has brought me up, and then I'll do Christchurch, and I'll have a couple of I'm having basically a week off after Christchurch. And then, you know, pacing Gold Coast will be fun. So,
what about, surely they've got to take a bit out. Like, are you feeling in fourth gear when you're banging out those 18:36Ks, though?
Other than the last 2K, I would have been, yeah.
What shoes and stuff are you doing them in?
Just the Zoom Flies.
Zoom Flies. So he's not even wearing the 4%ers. No. You put them on, you're running 17:50.
But I was going to say, that was the first session I've done since BWA where I had that, you know, the reps were slightly longer where I had to really just, you know, concentrate a little bit at the back end of it. Sunday felt good and then this afternoon just got rolling again as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, 3-course records for the week. You've been hunting a few of them.
Me?
Yeah. Did you know you got three?
Which ones? Well,
you got Mulligan's Flat Hill, course record on that, and you got the Pond full lap. And half already, well done.
But I already had that. I already had those. I've just broken my own record.
Yeah, sure.
McGowan's second, but for some reason he gets a message saying that I broke it, even though I already had it.
Yeah, rightio. Yeah. I reckon
it's a nice record. Reminder.
Yeah.
Very good. Big week for me, K-wise as well, but not quite that kind of quality you had, Brad. easy 16K in the morning on Monday. Had a shocking week. I was doing a lot of schoolwork, and I was down in Melbourne again Tuesday, so I did a lot of running at 5:30 this week, which bangs me up a bit. I don't know about you boys, but I can get up at 6 o'clock every day of the week, but when I start getting up at 5:30 or 5 or 5:45, it feels like a whole different ballpark, and it just makes me a bit more tired. But anyway, 16K in the morning on a Monday morning at 4:23s, and then 8.5K easy in the afternoon. Then I went down to Monash again. This was the last bit of testing, so I pretty much did exactly the same thing as I did last week. 2 hours on the treadmill at about 4:15 pace, getting off every 15 minutes and doing all the measurements, which is a bit of fun. So looking forward to seeing what that data brings back. On Wednesday, did an easy 16K in the morning. And then Wednesday night, we had our information night at school. So people that aren't school teachers like Julian would struggle to understand this. But you go to work, you work for the whole day, and then you slip out for a quick run. And then you go back to work for a couple more hours. So I think I got home at about 9:30 that night. So a bit of a split shift, fitted in a quick 10K run in between. And at a little town I work at, it's about 20 minutes out of Echuca. It's called Tongala, and it's got a couple of segments there. I didn't realise, but I went for a run and then uploaded it to my Strava, and then I got one course record and one second overall. Didn't even know I was running on them, so that was a bit exciting. Uploading that one and seeing some course records pop up in the small dairy farming town of Tongala. So that was a bit of fun for my Wednesday. Thursday, we cut the session this week, so I only had one session this week, so I just did strides in the afternoon, easy 8K in the morning, some 200-meter strides. I think there must be an athletics school meet coming up at the local grass track because the spray paint's back on the lines there, which is good. So rolled a couple of 200s in about 33, 34, which felt good to run a bit quicker. Friday, easy 8K in the morning, and then the highlight of my week, I had a crack at the old Port of Echuca course record again. Need to get your opinion on this one, boys. Went down there just like last week, did my stride through the Port of Echuca, which is a pretty iconic part of Australia. Overseas listeners probably see like Ayers Rock or Uluru and Sydney Harbour Bridge, Sydney Opera House, but Port of Echuca is probably top five. So it was good to have a crack through there again to try to get the iconic record. Anyway, got back to my car, uploaded it, tells me I got the course record, but it turns out the guy that had the course record had hidden his run, so I popped up on top. And then he, just to stuff with me, he re-put his off private, so then it would drop me back to second, which I thought was a bit of a dog act. What do you boys think about that one?
I think you it serves yourself right for chasing stupid Strava segments.
It's just to let the legs open up on a Friday afternoon, just before the Saturday session.
You've got it all wrong.
Anyway, so I've got Michael Kernahan helping me out now, trying to give me a bit of advice about the best ways to take down course records, and he's given me some good tips. This Strava run's probably got more comments on it than when I usually race. I think there's 25 comments on there now with Michael Kernahan's top Strava tips. So if you want to beat a course record, there's a couple of sneaky little tricks in there that I might be implementing next Friday night to see if I can get it. So I went 27 seconds through the port. Last week it was 29. Course record is 25, though. I've still got to find a couple more seconds. So, yeah, wish me luck, and we'll see how we go next week.
Next week it'll be the hammy.
I just roll through. Like, I'm just in my jogging shoes and stuff, and I'm just like, it's all dirt, and it's like, yeah, it's all historical. Like, they got old paddle steamers and, like, yeah, horses and carts and stuff through there. Like, I'm just striding out. It's nothing stupid. Like, I'm not risking hamstrings.
Why does Echuca have a port?
Why is Echuca have a port? Mate, this is like, we used to be, this is where people would get off the boat and stuff. Have you never been to the old port of Echuca? That's where the paddle steamers, we're a paddle steaming town.
Where do the paddle steamers go?
Yeah, back in the
river.
Back in the day, the paddle steamers used to go on the river and drop all the supplies off at the port.
What port?
The port,
you know,
of Echuca.
Have you heard of the Murray River?
You mean they go from one side of the river to the other?
No. They just go up and down the river to like different towns.
Different towns.
Learn this in like primary school?
About Echuca? No, it's not on our curriculum.
Oh, good word. for a non-school teacher. Yeah. So the old port's like it, and it's still set up real old school and stuff. Like it's, yeah, they've still got all old stuff down there. And it's, yeah, it's where all the tourists go all the time.
So isn't there an old picture theatre in Echuca?
OPT, yeah, that's also that's a nightclub.
I know, I've been there.
Oh, of course you've been there, but you haven't checked out any of the historical stuff.
That is historical.
Yeah.
I was there one night. It's now history.
So I'm going to keep having a crack at that because I felt good Saturday morning again, Bradley, and, trained well, 15K tempo, first 8K at marathon pace, then progress it for 4K, trying to hit half marathon pace and then working the last 2K home. Hit 15K at 3:13, which was good. Pretty similar to last week. Just did an extra K on it, mostly on the dirt again, which was promising. Heart rate at 162. I'm loving these sessions. Didn't look at the watch again, so it just bips and just don't look down at it. It's really kind of just feel free out there. Saw me boss. She was walking her dog. That was a highlight. That's about it. Sunday, I went for a run. Felt even awesome. Like I averaged 4:08s on the warm down that day. Like I just felt good. My heart rate was back down and. Yeah, I'm a bit like you, Brad, not feeling like a 2:17, man, but just starting to feel like things are clicking all right and just jogging at an easy pace and, what'd you say, covering the ground well? Is that your one?
Yeah, just moving across the ground well. Yeah,
I reckon it's some of that gym stuff as well, just activating a few muscles here and there. I don't know. And then
I agree with that. I think hills and gym work's been the biggest change for me over the last year. Mm. Just strength, yeah.
Do you do that crab walk one with the band?
I don't do the crab walk, but I do use the band to activate, like, glute med.
Yeah, I reckon those bands are all right. Moosh, you ever use those bands? Activating a few
things?
They're
a warm-up. The warm-up, the bands.
Yeah.
Then you tough get into band. The real, then tough, you throw
tough
iron.
Bands.
Yeah, band.
That's my little baby steps, the bands. That's your big weight workout.
No, I use it in my warm-up as well. But do you use that around the house, like, during the week?
No, I just... Gym time is gym time.
Sunday, just in hour 45, because I was on the treadmill for 2 hours on Tuesday. That was my long run, hour 45. Amazing how easy an hour 45 feels and how less exhausted you are the rest of the day compared to like a 2 hour or 2:15. Not sure if you boys feel the same, but hour 45 is still that kind of medium long run territory. And then, 6K in the afternoon, 186K week, felt good. Just stringing things together. That's my week. Not as good as Brad's.
Both good weeks.
Yeah, if I did Brad's week, blokes would be going me about racing every session. See, Brad's just...
Fitter than you at
he's
the
a
moment,
270
though,
like. Man as well. He just uses this excuse that like he just... Yeah, he is super fit.
I can see a Masters world record coming up soon. The way it's going.
two and a bit years.
World Masters Games. That's what he's racing for. He's not telling us a race. He's going for the Masters game.
Yeah, a bit
cheap. That's keeping my powder dry for maybe a bit too long.
it's good. You had a good week, Brady. You just got to keep ticking these off. You don't need, like, beware the super session. That's what Brad's always saying, and that's what you're doing now. That tempo is quality. Just accumulate a few of them, and all of a sudden... You've got that covered.
Yeah.
14K, 3:13s, is that right?
15K.
Yeah. I mean, that's a 10-mile tempo in 51 and a half minutes if you do another K, and that's bloody solid tempo.
Yeah, the good
and
thing
way
with...
faster than marathon pace too.
Yeah, the good thing with those, the good thing with those ones is it feels relatively comfortable for at least like the first 12:13, like until I'm trying to run a bit quicker at the end there. 3:10s and 3:12s, and like when I'm trying to run at marathon pace at the start, 3:15s and 16s feel like I don't want to say they feel like marathon pace because that's way quicker than what I've run for a marathon, but they feel in that zone where you're working but you're not really working, if that makes sense. I'm not sure if that does make any sense, but
yeah
you know that kind of middle zone where you're not working but you're just knocking them over.
I got it.
That's it. News for the week. Big news. Lyndon Hall breaks the Australian 1500 meter record.
Good run. I still haven't watched this race yet. Have you watched it?
I just saw some highlights. I watched that, and I watched Matthews go around in the International Mile, and then I watched that Norwegian kid run like a world record as well, maybe 3:52 for the mile. Did you watch that?
Jeez, nah, but I've seen him. He's a freak.
Yeah.
But that's Lyndon. That's a massive. Like, we haven't seen a world record in a distance for a long time in the
Australian
Aussie record.
Yeah, an Aussie record. Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean. So did she do it off the front? Did she do it from behind? Where did she finish in the race?
I think she was fifth. It was pretty close. Yeah, she probably wasn't in it for the win. There was probably two or three in front of her, and they kind of crossed the line at the same time, and she was kind of almost winning that next pack across the line. But, yeah, it's pretty solid effort. I think the main pack, or the pack that crossed the line, they were really tight together, and it was quite a good race. I think the lady who won it, I don't have her name here, but she, I think she was a bit of an upset.
Shelby Houlihan, I think.
Houlihan, that was
Shelby Houlihan.
Yeah, it's good. Matthews is pretty impressive in the International Mile as well, so good results for the Australians there, 3:57.02.
Yep, good win.
Pretty solid
good
stuff.
Good to win. Like, they're big races to win.
Yeah. Have you ever been in the States when that race has been on?
I've been there, but... I didn't went to it.
Yeah. Brad, you won over there, didn't you? Oregon? Prefontaine Classic?
In Coos Bay, a 10K fun run.
The Prefontaine Classic.
The Prefontaine Memorial Run.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's tough. I was presented, met his mum and sister.
You just say I won the pre.
Yeah.
It looks like a good event. I think if you're a track nerd, that's definitely one you've got to knock over and go watch that one year. Everyone's running pretty quick. Any other local news, AV? Tell us about this, Julian. You got some results there?
Yeah, I just keeping an eye on it while I'm not there and you're not there. Andy Buchanan from Bendigo finished second to Stewie McSween, former Ballarat runner, now runs for St. Stephen's. They did a lot of recruiting in the off season, and they picked up Stewie McSween. And he's been running Diamond League races, so to come back and support the AV cross country, that's pretty rad. I think really like it when I like to see that. Andre Waring was third from Box Hill. In the ladies event, Kaya Fry was first place. I think that's her first win for AV cross country as well. That was she ran away after halfway and ran on strongly to win from Emily Guy. I don't think it was the most stacked ladies field, but they had a really good race. A lady went out early and the pack pulled them back. Yeah, I think Kaya, I'm pretty sure Kaya is is my friend Lockie's girlfriend. Boy that I grew up with, Lockie McDonald. We were best friends until he moved to the other side of the state when I was like grade four or something, I reckon. And then I ended up catching up with him when I went and moved over there for a job one time. And we sort of stay connected in very weird ways like this. And now Kaya Fry runs at events that I run at, so I'm sure I'll run into him again. Don't think he's a podcast listener.
I don't think you just go on a podcast and say, I think this person is dating another person.
I'm confident. I knew it was a unique first name, so I'm going to go for it.
Yeah. Righty-o. Adelaide Marathon was also on. They threw off a bit of cash this year. I think we worked out off air $7,500 up for prize money for the female and the male section of the race. And
What was second place? What was second place win?
2,000. First was 2,500, and second was 2,000.
So last year, Bree came second at this race, and she didn't get anything. She didn't get a single piece of equipment, gear, pair of socks, bib. I don't know if she got a special bib. I don't know. Oh, she got a little trophy, plastic, average. And now they're putting up $2,500 for second, or $2,000 for second. That's an injection of cash.
Did it work, though? If you're putting up that kind of money, are you expecting some pretty fast times to come first, second, and third? Because it was one in 2:32. Second was Dion Finocchiara of 20 seconds behind a week after he came third to you last week, Great Ocean Road. So he's backed
that
up.
That man must
up
have
pretty
some
quick.
Gambling debt or something. He is looking to pay off someone because no one would chase money like that except for him.
Yeah. But, yeah, like I guess back to the original question, do you think they've wasted that kind of money putting it up in that way?
No, well, I'm going to quote one of the other runners that race. I won't name him, but he's from Adelaide. His statement was about the race, tough course, lots of small mounds and hairpins. Adelaide could put together a world-class marathon course, but local councils piss all over road closure applications, which is why Creighton is going to WA instead. It's sad, really. And you'd sort of think, oh, with all this cash, couldn't you put that into, I don't know, building a better course? However, it does. He mentions that the councils, they can the road closure applications. It's not a case of money. So it sounds like a difficult situation for the race. Mm. The lady, so we should mention the lady. Oh, Michael Nischke, a podiatrist from over that way, sent me some very good information on my plantar fasciitis. So he was third, yep. So good run by him in some clapped out 4% he ran in. In the ladies, Beck Rozelle, she's a Victorian. She won in 2:53, which is a big marathon win. Rachel Glasson was second, and Amelia Griffith, another Victorian, was third in 3 hours and 7 minutes.
Oh, so Bree wouldn't have been far off. She would have picked up cash. Top five got paid.
I don't know. I haven't seen the results. I know they obviously got a couple more better runners this year. Maybe the cash helped that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Do you reckon now that people know this kind of cash is there, next year it's going to be wanting like 220?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. Most of the good runners go to Grey Ocean Road, so I'm not sure they'll be able to back up.
did that comment, did you mention Sean Crichton, which is why Sean Crichton is going to WA instead?
Sean Crichton's name has been thrown out.
Well, you got Sean Crichton news, Brad. What's going on with the old mate?
Yeah, he's running. So he was going to run Adelaide Marathon, but then WA contacted him and he sort of looked into both courses and, yeah, realised that Adelaide was sort of on bike paths and things like that. So he's actually running, Perth Marathon in a few weeks, actually. So mid-June, I think. So he's trying to, I think, go somewhere around 2:30-odd.
Mm, it would have been winning it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's funny, he did his... he flew over to Adelaide yesterday and actually did his long run down there yesterday afternoon. He ran like 37K, so he probably could have done. Probably could have jumped in and done the marathon.
Was that because he already had flights booked and stuff? He was already going.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure if he was over there for work or not.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's good that people are putting up money and stuff. Like, you know, think about Dion. He's picking up wins. Canberra second at Hobart this year. Well, third at Great Ocean Road. Second at Adelaide. Yeah, as you're right, he might have some big debts to pay off because he's rolling in the big cash money.
Yeah, or he's planning on some. Maybe he's just trying to buy another pair of 4%.
They're getting expensive. Hey, let's thank some Patreon supporters this week. They're still rolling in. Thanks to all the people who are supporting the show on Patreon. I was talking to Josh Harris about this yesterday, actually. We had to change one of the little things behind the scene to give people access to the old bonus episodes. We had to change a bit of a setting there, but hopefully everyone who's pledged $15 now gets access to those bonus episodes. Fire us away, Brad. Start thanking some people off this list of paper.
Well, I'll start with Josh Harris. So, obviously, Aussie rep last year at the World Champs, and he's had a rough trot in the last year, but... hopefully he'll be back out running shortly. Thanks to Tash Fraser, Brad
Tash
Martin.
Tash Ballarat runner. Let's Tash not Fraser. Go apart.
Winner of the 60K outright the other week, yeah? That's the same Tash Fraser?
Yep, she's won a lot of races, and she's training for the World 100K race in, I don't know where it is, Spain maybe? Spain, I think. Sure. Brad Martin, I'm going to shout out to Brad Martin too. Brad, Ballarat runner. Just crushes his running at the moment.
maybe went overboard on the run before Great Ocean Road where he ran 13K at about half marathon pace. Strava doesn't lie. But had a great one at Great Ocean Road and ran a PB still. So he's looking to run a good one at Gold Coast.
And I'll give a shout out to Ben Buckingham. I'm pretty sure he's a former winner of the Nail Can Hill run and a very handy steeplechaser.
Yeah, he's elite. He's like a national champ, yeah. Isn't he?
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah, he's a good runner.
Good runner.
Jason Stevens. Well, Brady's mate, but he's my mate too because he supported the store down in Ballarat. Drove all the way down with his mate.
Yeah, mentioned them last week. Jason and Josh came down. They're training well, those boys too. Training really well from Swan Hill. Thanks for the support there, Jason. Michael Spray. I don't know Michael personally.
Don't go Michael Spray. The running company, Launceston owner, one of the greatest men you'll ever meet.
Oh, lucky I didn't start talking about him because you are. Yeah, you know all the stuff there. Michael Spray, Brendan Fink. Anyone know Brendan Fink?
No.
I reckon Brendan might have just followed me on Strava and we were discussing the Pegasus.
Very good.
Yep.
James Mason, Stephen Keeley, and Stephen Eddie. Thank you very much for your support. We appreciate that, guys. If you want to help the show financially, you can easily go to patreon.com/insiderunningpodcast. There's different rewards there that link up with how much you want to chip in. So thanks to those people who are doing that already and value our work. Listener question, Joshua Rowe. This one came in yesterday, Julian, and I think you met Joshua. Do you want to read it out and then we might have a bit of a yarn about it?
All right. My name's Joshua. Oh, well, he gives us a bit of kudos first. My name's Joshua. For some context, I participated in my first marathon at Great Ocean Road and stopped by the running company Ballarat to have a chat with Julian pre-race. I think that was with his dad, Brett. I'm 18 years old and a keen half, 83 minutes, and marathon, 3:02 runner. PBs, 3:02 is at Great Ocean Road with a stiff headwind. I added that. He didn't talk himself up there. I'm looking at different universities to study at next year, e.g. Sydney, Canberra, Ballarat, not Echuca. Good call. Very good call, Josh.
Well, great call. We don't even have a university, Josh.
No, but...
Oh, mate, you can't bag us out. We don't even have one.
No, it would be a good spot for a uni up there.
Couldn't afford to rent up here.
If you boys could discuss or give me some insight on the best uni for distance running opportunities alongside study. All right. Oh. So this is a good question.
This is a good
because
question.
Because, I'm going to jump in... put my opinion first. I don't think you look at the internal culture of the running sector of the school, like the Sydney University Athletics Club or Melbourne Uni or Federation Uni or whatever. I think you've got to look at where the college or the uni is and how good the running would be in the area you're going to live. Because Federation Uni does not have a running team as such in Ballarat, but some of the best runners in the country have come down and spent time there and got very fit living in the area. But you wouldn't call it a strong running university. So have a look at where the campuses are, how accessible to trails it is. Is there a track there? Is it, yeah, that'd be the things I would look at. And so I guess when we look at that, we name some universities what that would be. Ballarat, for sure.
Chico
Deakin
State.
University, Geelong. Chico State, right next to Bidwell Park. Good running location. I don't know about Canberra. Did Canberra have unis?
Yeah, we've got two. We've got the ANU and University of Canberra. So obviously Canberra's a great place for training. Neither of those universities have a very strong athletics program. I went to Sydney Uni and did my undergrad there. They have a very, very strong athletics program and a good scholarship program. So in terms of assistance, Sydney Uni would be, I'd say, one of the better universities in the country for that. And they also run a very good social program. I had heaps of fun at the four uni games that I went to when I was at Sydney Uni. Yep.
Off the rails back in the day. Sounds like Josh is though more of a distance runner. Like he's not going to be registering for the track team. Like, wouldn't you? Yeah, I think I agree with Julian. You'd move to where there's already a culture of distance running in that town and just going there for the university is kind of a bonus.
Yeah, Yeah.
Which
yeah.
can like,
you look at
Gay Chain well, with Brad every week at Mulligan Flats, you'd be right.
Yeah, and some guys have actually done that in Canberra, like guys like Jordan Guzman and who Rory Hunter. Like they've moved down here for study, but mainly because of, you know, they want to be coached by Dick Telford and the running that it offers, more so than the actual athletics program at those universities. So yeah, that they've put their running first, and then just tried to work out where they can go to uni that's close to the best running. Or what's going to be best for their running.
Yeah. Get in a group, though, Josh. There's nothing worse than training by yourself most every night of the week, I reckon. Get in a good culture and just get sucked along.
I don't mind totally training by myself.
No. Yeah, but you're a bit older and stuff. You've got a few years of experience.
That's not my choice either.
you've been kicked out of too many groups.
I get sick of waiting for groups to start on time. No, go and do my own thing.
You're getting better at that, though. You're starting to train with a few more people, be a bit more sociable.
Yeah, occasionally. The Kangaroos, Mulligan's Flat.
No one can keep up with you. Fang it too easy on the too hard on the easy days. Hope that answers your question, Josh. Moose on the loose.
I'll make it quick. Moose on the loose tonight goes out to all those beginner running coaches, personal trainers, unknowledgeable practitioners who have this obsession with convincing people that they need to run on the front of their foot, land on the front of their foot in order to perform better, to be injury free, or to be running the bracket. Is that what you say? Bracket, quotation mark, right way, quotation mark. Gee, it's tough doing that on a podcast. But the amount of people coming or that I'm running into at events or sending questions over the internet, coming into the store, telling me that they were running the wrong way, which was landing on their heel, and that their so-and-so has told them that they need to change to their forefoot running, like to a forefoot running style where they don't land on their heel or their midfoot, they land on their forefoot. It's just out of control at the moment. Like immediately I ask, what injuries do you have? Like what has prompted this change in running style? No injuries, they say. I just don't want to get one. And it's almost as if there's like an opportunity to start making money around having people change their running style, and everyone's trying to jump on board by promoting running coaching and like run the right way, all this bizarre things like where it's just not required. Like people should be getting out there and being encouraged to go and run if they don't have any injuries the way they naturally feel they should run. There's a fantastic image of the top, I think it's the top 15 runners at the US Olympic trials one year in the 10,000 meters, where they took a high frame image of the foot's landing position. And so you're looking at the top 15 runners in the US, and not a single person has the same strike position as the person next to them. Half of them are landing on their heel, even with spikes on, which is very counterintuitive, you would suggest, or it very much counters the theory that we would always run on our midfoot if we didn't have a heel in our shoe. It just, at the moment, it feels like people are taking advantage of lack of knowledge by encouraging them to pay money to learn these different things when they don't need to. And it's a relevant thing if someone's suffering from sort of chronic injuries like shin pain or knee issues. However, changing your running style is a very slow and tedious process that needs to be respected. It's not something that you just do overnight because your personal trainer straight out of an 8-week AIF online course tells you to. So if you want to learn about mechanics, go and see a physiotherapist or a higher level running coach who's done training in biomechanics, or even a biomechanist
who will actually guide you through the process properly and maybe even advise you whether it's worth changing or not. Because there's a lot more discussion to this than simply saying heel is bad, forefoot is good. That's an accumulation of weeks building to that little moose on the loose.
So what you're taking out of that is don't change your technique, like just run naturally.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's not that wasn't an advice moose on the loose. That was me ranting at people telling other people to change when they don't need to. But if you want to get into it, we can have another podcast on what we should do. We can do that another time.
Yeah. Are those bonus content sessions?
Bonus content. Let's talk about running technique. Let's talk about...
that'd be a good topic.
Foot strikes.
So I think what you're saying is if you're not injured and you're running, then don't change anything until you actually have an
injury. Yeah, if you have an injury that might be related to running technique, that's the time to investigate it, not when you're crushing it. It would be like Brad at the moment having his physio go, hey, have you ever thought about totally overhauling your running style? When he's running 180 and he's one of the, if not the best runner in Australia.
The best. Very good. Yeah, it's a good topic. I like that. And are you noticing a lot of those people are like, are they getting that off experts or is it like, yeah, PTs or they're reading it on the internet or YouTube videos or?
There's a very grey area when you say expert. Someone who does a two-day coaching course does not make them an expert in running technique. Same with a physio who's never done any real biomechanics training or running technique stuff. Same with a personal trainer. Or there are, like, you can get someone who has no qualification that is an expert in running technique. It's very person to person, but just because someone has a certificate on the wall doesn't mean you should follow crazy advice. But there are great people to see out there if you want to change your technique or talk about your mechanics or your running style.
Yeah, good moose on the loose.
Don't go on the internet for it. You'll run into strife very quickly.
He's sounding pretty calm after this marathon too, isn't he, Brad? He's just a bit calmer tonight.
Yeah, he's very calm, actually.
I thought people are paying, like, now we've got Patreons. I'm going to just comment. I'm going to be a bit smarter. I'm going to actually listen. I've turned off Facebook, Strava, those other websites. So now I'm actually listening to what you're saying.
Well, he hasn't been training all week, so he's not tired and grumpy.
Yeah,
I reckon most of the Patreons are paying for Moose on the Loose anyway. I reckon they're paying for you to be a loser.
I might have a few beers next week and psych me up. You should just get me. You know how to get me riled. You do it through the message that we group that we have. You know how to get me going.
I've got you fired a few times lately. Yeah, I've got you. Yeah. I'll keep that off air though. Some of that stuff. That's a bit hard. That's good. Colas Birmingham's coming up this week. Good news today. We've got 3 pairs of Nike Pegasus, the brand new ones to give away.
The number 35.
Now, are they different? We've just had Dominic from Spain, Brad's mate from over in Spain, was drinking sangria with him last time when he was over in Spain. He just wrote in a quick question about half an hour ago wondering if we could maybe just talk about why these shoes are so good and if they're different than the old pegs.
Few quick differences. Biggest difference, in term, if you read about it and how it feels, there's a full-length Zoom Air unit that runs through this Pegasus 35. In the past, I believe it's only been in the heel, or maybe only in the forefoot. I think it's only in the heel, in the 34, but now it's full-length Zoom Air in it, so it's going to be a lot smoother. So when your foot hits the deck, it's going to have the same feel as until you toe off. There'll be a nice, even, smooth transition. There's a lot more beveling in the heel, kind of like, you know, on the 4%ers, how there's a real weird kick up at the back, so that bevel, if you're landing through the heel, it helps to transition you onto your forefoot or through your gait cycle. Like, it's not a real blocky, harsh feel. It's a very smooth transition, almost like a rocker. There's the mesh and the booty fit, so it's a very secure feel, this new one. Probably not as voluminous in the toe box as the 34. It's going to be a tighter feel, more secure around the foot, maybe not for wide feet. That'll be a bit of a warning, I reckon, a bit of a red flag. If your foot, if you stick your hoof in there and there's a bit of tightness, may not be the right shoe for you anymore. The heel collar caused some dramas for some people. I reckon it might have caused dramas for Brad, where it was a little bit too aggressive and it dug into the Achilles, creating some irritation. So this one here, they've kind of like curved it away from the heel. Bigger tongue. I reckon that'll help to secure the heel with that beveled heel collar. 10 mil offset. Like one of the biggest differences that they won't call out on paper that we notice in the store a lot is the Pegasus 34 has like this this concave almost and the lateral border of the midsole. And this concave, what happens when it gets loaded, it squashes and it collapses. And so we see a lot of stability issues with the Pegasus 33 and 34 in particular. If someone's a very heavy lateral striker, then they really collapse and fall off the shoe initially. And over time, that wears and it compresses really quickly. So with this new shoe, there's no concave in that lateral border. So we think it'll last longer for people and it will be a little more stable on landing.
They look good too. Pretty good looking, yeah. I don't know about all that stuff you're just talking about, but they look nice.
Brady on the special comments, good.
Oh, I'm just, yeah, cosmetically, they look all right. No idea what
they
you're
look
talking
amazing.
About.
Yeah, I really do. Want my foot to fit in there. I've got a bit of a broad, bit of a flipper, so I'm a bit worried that my foot's not going to get in there.
Three pairs of those to give out. You've got to buy a ticket before the day, though, to go in the running for that one. Colas is hyped up. He's looking forward to it. True, Julian.
Correct. Won't stop talking about it. I better not go too far. I haven't seen him in a couple of weeks. But, no, he'll be there. I can guarantee that.
Oh, I hope so. Benny Walker's
going to
be there.
The shoes will be
well.
There too.
Benny Walker's going to be there. Shoes will be there. Julian's going to be there. We're practicing our interviewing skills. Julian's just listening to the Ross Murray interview over and over, just trying to like fine-tune his questioning. you listen to that one yet?
Yeah, I listened early to Ross Murray.
Brad Dazza still hasn't listened to it.
Next cab off the rank.
Next one, yeah. You'll start taking some podcasts with the Mulligans runs out there, I reckon. Just keep you company. Slow you down a bit.
Yeah, no, I'll stick to my Johnny Cash and Taylor Swift. That's the key.
Wow.
All right. I'm not joking either.
We know you're not joking.
Stuff around with Swifty. Swifty's all right. She's got some good beats.
A bit of Ellie Goulding, a bit of Miley Cyrus.
All right. We've talked about this before.
It's getting embarrassing.
All right, what's coming up? Brad's going to New Zealand. When do you go, Brad?
Early Saturday morning. So it's a pretty quick trip. So, fly out of Canberra at 20 past 6 Saturday.
Direct
race
flight?
Sunday. Now I've got to go to Melbourne.
Oh, down in Melbourne.
Yeah, so I get in there about 2:30 in the afternoon and then race Sunday.
They're a couple of hours ahead or behind over there. What's New Zealand? They're behind, aren't they?
Yeah, they're ahead. No, they're ahead.
So you get there dinner time on Saturday night?
No, so I get there at 2 o'clock their time.
Oh, their time. Yeah, right.
Yeah, 2:30, yeah, their time.
Vivian going with you?
Nah, just solo.
Fine solo. What are you doing, Julian?
This week?
Yeah.
Just working.
Just working.
You know, got to get this bloody event right. Got to get it done. Yeah, Smooth out all the wrinkles and, you know.
Sound a bit worried about this event. A bit nervous. It's your hometown as well. Are you putting on some beers? Putting on some beers down there?
Maybe for the locals. buy a few locals some beers, yeah.
That'd be nice for you. Yeah, it'd be good. Yep, looking forward to that. I'll be there setting up some microphones with Benny Walker. You want to buy a CD? Benny will be selling some CDs down there maybe. I don't know. He's a big dog. He'll be doing that kind of stuff if you want one. Shake his hand. Thank him for the music every week. Brad, this week's interview, Ben Wispy.
Yeah, we did something a bit different this week. I guess, you know, at the start of every episode, we discuss our training. So I thought, why not sit down with the guy that has, I guess, the greatest influence in what I do each day of the week, and that's my coach, Ben. So we chatted about his introduction into coaching, his time working with the Sydney Swans and other AFL clubs, talk about some, I guess, the greatest training mistakes that he sees people do, coach-athlete relationships, and often just questions that I ask him, you know, like, why do I do 5x1K and not 6 or 8, which sort of most, you know, distance runners do, or now that I'm a marathoner, why don't I do 2.5 hours every Sunday? So, yeah, just picked his brain a little bit, so I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Have you listened to it, Julian?
No.
Thanks for the support.
I will.
Too
I
busy.
Wish I could get in on it, though. I would have enjoyed getting in on it.
Yeah.
It's good.
Just open that up, I reckon.
It's good. It's good. It's a good chat. He says some good things. I can always, very smart man.
I can always ask him other questions. So.
Yeah, I'll put a list together.
All right.
Yeah. One thing he did say in there, that everyone should have a coach. The old wise man over here, no coach.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Enjoy this interview. Where are you going? We ramble. We're all over the shop tonight, but hopefully the listeners enjoy that show. That's what they sign up for, a bit of rambling about running. Thanks for this. Thanks for your time, boys. And we'll see you again next week, episode number 31.
Bye-bye. See you then.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Alright, we've decided to do something a little bit different this week. As you know, at the start of the weekly podcast, we discuss our training, and I thought, why not get the guy who sets most of my training on as a guest to, I guess, find out about his coaching philosophy, how he got into coaching, and things like that. So, welcome to my coach, Ben Wisby. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thanks, Croaks. It's good to be on. Been a long-time listener, so, yeah, good to get the opportunity to have a chat.
Yeah, I should give you a bit of a shout-out as well, because you are a patron, and, yeah, you've chipped in to pay for this microphone that I'm speaking into at the moment, so cheers.
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to get the signed photo.
Yeah, as we said before, from the private collection. So let's maybe start with how you got into running, because most of our listeners probably won't know that you're actually a pretty decent runner yourself. So maybe how you got into running and what your PBs are?
Yeah, sure. I guess I never did organised running competitions as a kid, but sort of from the age of about 15, I gradually became addicted to running, and I'm not really sure why, and none of my mates did it. It was just something that intrigued me, and sort of started running 5K in the morning and then 5K in the night, and then suddenly I was doing it day in and day out, and there was no real plan or knowledge behind it, no desire to race. But I guess over the years that just grew, and you know, it became an obsession and an addiction like it does for most runners. So I guess that was just a slow introduction that gradually built up and, you know, became a big part of life because of the interest in it, in terms of, you know, both continuing that on now, you know, 25-odd years later, but also from a work perspective in terms of, you know, rolling my passion for sport into, you know, what I do as a career as well. Mm. In terms of, you know, PBs, et cetera, I wouldn't say I'm a great runner by any means. I'm a punter who is loves running and, you know, spends a lot more time doing it than my results probably indicate. But Yeah, so I guess the PB, some of these are pretty old now. I think I had a 5K of 16:59, but that'd probably be a good 18 years ago or so now. 10K of 35:17. Only ever done a couple of half marathons at a, you know, at a decent intensity, and I think they're a low 77 was the best. And then the only recent PB I have from sort of the last decade is the marathon, which was last year in Melbourne, where I got a 2:50 and 8 seconds. So I guess throughout most of my running career, my goal's always been just to go under 2 hours and 50 minutes, and almost got there, but not quite. So we'll you know, keep soldiering on at that one to see how it goes.
Yeah, and Christchurch in 2 weeks' time is the goal, hey? Hopefully sub 2:50 there.
It would be nice to do that, yeah. So it's a really flat course, and, you know, in reasonable shape. So definitely an opportunity to do it, but it's also a bit of a lonely course at Christchurch. It's generally not a big field, and some of the bits, once you get sort of out of town a bit, there's not many people around. So, you know, I guess it's more around that mental concentration to be able to sustain it, which obviously differs to Gold Coast, where you could, you know, sit in with 100 people and get carried along to 30K. But, yeah, it should be good.
Oh, well, I'm sure the listeners will keep track of the result. So let's get into the coaching, because there was a period where you were like a full-time coach. You're not doing it as much anymore. We're actually not sort of doing it as a career. You only coach, what, myself and a couple other mates?
Yeah, that's right. It's, I guess I don't think I ever did it full time. It was probably for over a decade. It was probably either part time or three quarter time that was coaching. And I guess that my interest in coaching started pretty young. Like, even before I left school, I was just completely obsessed with performance. Even though, you know, I liked running at that point, but the obsession with, you know, physical performance wasn't just for running. It was in general. And I guess that then, when I started university, it was to study sports science, and at that same time started to assist with some coaching of triathlon in Canberra, and that gradually led to a part-time paid position coaching triathlon, which I then got out of as I moved more into sports science, and then started doing more of my own sort of private coaching, because I definitely preferred running than triathlon coaching, and you know, basically started to sell my services as a coach, and do more and more of that. So, which was, you know, more from an online perspective. So I guess it's different to being hands-on. Sometimes it has its benefits, and sometimes it has its drawbacks. But yeah, that was where a lot of the work I did for about a decade from a coaching point of view. But I guess over time, I started spending more time doing sports science work and working with professional and elite athletes, and sort of the coaching took a bit of a backseat and continued to do it through that whole time, but sort of became a bit more of a hobby than an occupation, sort of over the last, so I guess, 5 or 8 years.
And who would you say have been your greatest influence as a coach? And do you want to touch on, I know that you worked with the Sydney Swans, an AFL team, for those that don't know. So, one, who were your greatest influences? And two, what was your role within the Swans? And did you take anything away from working with a professional sports team?
Yeah, they're good questions. Greatest influences, I don't think I have one. You know, I've always read a lot, and I guess the exposure from a sports science point of view to a whole variety of sports means you learn a great deal from things outside of just running. So I wouldn't say I'd point to one great influence, but I think that the real luck I've had is the ability to work with a whole range of high-level sporting teams. So, you know, whether that be something like the Swans that you mentioned, or, you know, whether it be like elite cyclists, or, you know, just junior soccer coaches. So, you know, being exposed to that sports science, you really see a whole range of coaches, and you're working with them day in and day out, and seeing the way they approach things, you know, not just from specific to their sport, but more general. And I think that's probably the sort of greatest influence I had, that basically led me to just feel that every athlete's different, and, you know, there's no one size fits all. Yeah. But in terms of rolling that into the second part of your question with the Swans, I guess that was a great experience, but it sort of happened by chance. So I spent about 7 years as a sports scientist at the ACT Academy of Sport, and when I finished up there, I wanted to set up my own company and offer sports science services to professional teams. And I had a colleague who was completely in love with AFL and had some connections in that industry, and I'd never even watched a game at that point. We started to meet with the Swans and started to do a bit of work with them, which was, sports science always sounds very exciting and sexy, but the reality is we were analysing a whole heap of data and really just trying to, firstly, the players were wearing GPS units in games. So this was in 2004, 2005, I think, where GPS in team sports was new and no one had done it before. So we were spending a lot of time just crunching numbers and trying to understand, you know, what players go through in games. And then that progressed into also doing some other monitoring to see how recovered those athletes were during training and provide sort of training advice prior to key sessions to the head of the performance section of the Swans. So I guess what my role was, I guess it was consultant sports scientist, but specifically around, you know, data monitoring. But that was an awesome experience because, you know, got to meet a range of those players and work with them, but also to be exposed to things behind the scenes in, you know, professional sport at a level like that was great. And it led to a range of other opportunities where I end up, you know, working with West Coast Eagles, Adelaide Crows, Richmond Tigers, but also I had a relationship with the AFL themselves for about 10 years where we sort of took data from all 18 of the teams. So that only finished up a couple of years ago. So, yeah, my non-exposure to the AFL ended up being, turning into a decade later being a total love with the sport. And even though I don't work in the sport anymore, I really do still love watching the game.
Yeah, to the point that because you're based in New Zealand now, if the Swans have a Saturday night game, you're up till after midnight watching.
Yeah, I hate night games. I'm not a night person. So when they start at 9:30 or so, and I know I'm going to be up to midnight, it's tough. But still do it and enjoy watching it. And, you know, you asked about what you learn from that. And I guess it's like I mentioned before, you're just exposure to different sports and different coaches in general. You learn a lot. But I think the one thing, you know, the exposure to AFL was the difference in the professionalism in players. So, you know, I'd done most of my work prior to that as a sports scientist had been with elite cyclists, and, you know, very similar to runners. They're individual, they're very motivated, they're very driven, whereas in team sports you get that type of player, but you also get the type of player who's probably not so dedicated. Yeah. So, you know, it's really trying to understand the different individuals within the team and therefore be able to, use the right information to motivate them in the right way and to be able to give the right information back to them. So I think that was the biggest learning experience, that at first you've got this shock of, well, this guy's getting paid, you know, more money than most of the athletes I've worked with before, but yet he's not willing to do these little things to get better. And that it wasn't the case for them all, but it was, you know, it's definitely the case for some of them in any team sport.
Yeah, great answer. With the running coaching, you've pulled away from that recently. What were the challenges that you found doing that? And I guess why did you sort of decrease the amount of coaching that you're doing?
That's a tough question. I think one of the parts is, you know, doing lots of hands-on coaching is very time-consuming, and even though that's really enjoyable and something I've always been passionate about, after a while it becomes a huge time commitment, and it starts taking away from the things that you like doing yourself as well, you know, such as running. Mm-hmm. So I guess that was one of the reasons, you know, coming back a lot of the hands-on coaching, and, you know, you end up coaching more of your mates who you run with anyway, you know, because then you get the best of both worlds. A lot of the online coaching, I guess, I started to cut back on because, you know, other areas of work were starting to expand, and I'd been doing the coaching for a long time, and it's very time intensive. And it's something that if you don't have you know, if you're starting to lose a little bit of interest or you're wanting to do something else, then it's not fair to the athlete, you know, that if you're not completely dedicated. So, you know, with that in mind, at one point I was coaching a large number of runners, and I just gradually cut that back and continued to do coaching, but at a much more relaxed level, where I was able to still give that time, but, you know, not have to give it to a huge number of people. So I that's probably a pretty lame answer, because there's not a specific reason, but, you know, I guess it's the same as any career. You go through phases of different interests, you know, as you progress.
Did you find the online coaching, it was hard to develop a relationship with those athletes?
Yeah, it's interesting. Some, you know, some you would give a program and, you know, I'd always work in 4-week blocks, and you wouldn't hear anything until the end of the 4-week block. And that's the hardest, right? Well, you could, you can think, well, that's easy. You do the program and it's done, and, you know, it's low work. But the reality is it makes it really difficult to know how to progress the athlete, because you're not getting that feedback. So, the athletes I really enjoyed working with, I guess, were the ones who did give that feedback. And that's the biggest challenge with online coaching, is because you're not there, you know, you really need to be able to be in touch with the, you know, with the runner throughout, and try and get an understanding of what they're going through so you can progress the load appropriately. And, you know, I guess as many other coaches are in that situation, have been aware of that, you know, having regular conversations on the phone can go a long way in terms of overcoming some of those challenges and just getting the right information.
Well said. And which brings me to the coach-athlete relationship. So did you find that when you're coaching, your relationship with your athletes differed depending on the level of athlete? So somebody who's been doing it for, you know, 20-odd years, for example, like myself. So I have a fair idea of what's involved with a running program and things like that. Do you find that your relationship with an athlete's different to than a beginner?
Yeah, definitely. I think you know, as a coach, I always see the role when working with a beginner runner is to educate them. So yes, there's the scheduling of a program and saying, here's what you need to go and do. But it's more getting them to understand the basics, all of the things we take for granted about, you know, listening to the body and, you know, when they've got a niggle, do this, or what intensity means, or nutrition, all these things that as an experienced runner you don't think about, you know, they haven't been exposed to before. So I think that's the biggest focus when you're dealing with a novice runner, is to almost use the training program you're riding as a way of getting a conversation about, you know, different parts of learning about running in their body, where you compare that to an experienced runner like yourself, where, you know, you've been doing this as long as I have, and it becomes more of a partnership. So, you know, as you'd know, you know, when we work out your program, it's not me saying, okay, here you go, Croaks, here's what you're doing for the next block. It's very much back and forward until we come to a point that we're both comfortable with. And quite often, you know, the role from the coach is almost just like the little bird on your shoulder saying, hey, do you think that's actually smart? And, you know, just trying to keep things in check and, you know, look at things in an unbiased and unemotional manner. I think when you're the runner yourself, then you very much get caught up in what you're doing, and sometimes that causes you to make the mistakes that you'd like to avoid.
Yeah, I've said to multiple people that I always see you as, in a way, my handbrake to a point, because as you said, runners are so invested that, and for most runners, they're just so obsessive that more is better. So you often need to have, I guess, somebody there saying, hey, maybe just cut that back by 10%, or just err on the side of caution a little bit more. So, but I guess yes, we sort of have a partnership, and I think it's really important that athletes have buy-in in what they're doing, which I think you can do that when you're a more experienced runner. Did you find when you were coaching beginner athletes, they didn't have the same level of buy-in because they didn't really understand the sport as well?
Yeah, I think it's about expectations as well. So, you know, for an experienced runner like yourself, then you've got a clear goal of what's achievable and what it's going to take to get there. Whereas for the novice runner, they don't have that understanding yet of, you know, what it's going to take to get a certain outcome. So, you quite often will get people say, well, I've never run before, but, you know, in 3 months' time, I want to run under 3 hours for my first marathon. Mm-hmm. And for most people, that's, you know, not a likely scenario. So I guess it's trying to get a connection with them and a buy-in on another way where you sort of own the direction a bit and you're really just trying to get, I guess, their confidence. And once again, as I said before, you know, coming back to bring that around education and turning that into an education point for them so that they can learn. And I guess for me, I always found that if an athlete after a couple of years, you know, was happy to move on and didn't want my coaching services anymore, then in a lot of ways that was good progress. If I felt that was because they could go off and do their own thing, then, you know, I think at that point that's half the battle, is just getting them to a point that they know enough to make sensible decisions.
Yeah. All right, let's get into some nitty-gritty training talk and maybe discuss a bit about what your training philosophy and also maybe some of the biggest training mistakes that you see people doing in general.
Yeah, training mistakes. I think that you can probably make, there's probably more mistakes to make than there are right decisions, right? It's a sport where it's so hard to get it right and it's so easy to get it wrong. You know, you're trying to walk sort of a tightrope and it's very easy to underdo it or to overdo it. But I guess the one that I've always found most frustrating is probably people who always chase the latest, greatest thing. So, you know, they read something that somebody's been doing this type of approach to training and off they go and do that for a month. And a month later, it wasn't working for them. So they've jumped on the next bandwagon and they never actually progress anywhere because they've never given anything the time or the opportunity to actually have a positive impact. So, you know, it's like in your situation, you're now running well, but you know it's after 20 years that you finally run a marathon PB, and some of these things they don't come quickly, right? And it takes just a lot of hard work. So I think sometimes people looking for the shortcuts instead of just being patient to chip away. So, but you know, the list of training mistakes could go on and on. And you know, I think even you and I could sit here and say, well, what training mistakes have we made with your training over the last couple of years? And, you know, we could talk about that for an hour in itself. So, you know, even once you start to know more and have more experiences, you continue to make endless mistakes. And there's a whole lot of trial and error involved in getting the right outcome.
Yeah, but I think that's good advice. Because I remember one of the first things you said to me when you took, direction with my training was that there's no one way of doing this. There's multiple ways of training for a marathon, but I think what you've just touched on there is it doesn't matter what way you do it, just stick with a certain way for longer than a month or two. Have confidence in what you're doing and trust the process.
Yeah, and you know, it does take a while to evolve that as well, right? Like if we look over the last couple of years that we've been working together where, you know, we had Canberra and then Berlin and then Biwa, then, you know, Canberra was a bit more of a generic approach to marathon preparation because I guess you didn't know your body so well as a marathon runner at that point. And we hadn't worked together much before. And then we, you know, we progressed that for Berlin and probably, you know, jumped into marathon specific training, you know, a little bit too early. And then probably fine-tune that a bit for Biwa, and you know it's a world apart from the way you approached Canberra 12 months ago. And I think that sometimes it takes that time to go through that learning phase to get the right outcome. And even then, you know, that's over the course of 18 months or 2 years, and still needing to progress that training to get a better outcome because we're still learning. Yeah. So you know, it's definitely something that you can't jump in and do a month of training and then make a judgment call and head in a completely different direction because, unfortunately, sort of, yeah, you can't learn that quickly to get the right outcome.
And do you come from more of a – because I know with the training that you've been setting for me, it's definitely more of a strength and volume-based program and less speed. Is that your general philosophy, or you look at the athlete, like I guess in my case – I've come from more speed background, so you felt like that my weakness was my strength, so I had to work on that, or you're a big believer in strength work anyway?
Well, probably a bit of both. I think firstly, you know, the only real training philosophy I have is that everybody's an individual, and you know, there's no one size fits all. So, you know, everyone's coming from a different background. Everybody responds differently. Everyone's got different stresses outside of training. And therefore, you need to take all those things into account when getting to the right point. So, you know, even when we look at your training specifically, it hasn't just all been strength. You know, when we first started working together, it was probably a bit more traditional with a bit more speed work in there in the marathon preparation. And it's just through that, we've learned that that probably isn't needed. And, you know, your body operates quite well to getting a marathon outcome with doing less speed and just being very consistent and doing more strength work. But I guess at the same time, I do feel that for marathon running, you know, for most of us to run a good marathon, it's not actually that fast. It's just about running at a decent speed and being able to sustain it and be fatigue resistant. So I think for a lot of people, then strength and strength endurance is probably the limitation for a marathon outcome.
And all right, let's touch on marathon training then. A general marathon specific build up, how long is too long and how short is too short, do you think?
Yeah, I guess, look, once again, it's very individual. So as a general rule of thumb, I'd say sort of 10 to 12 weeks is a good number to use to you know, hit 10 weeks out. If you're capable of running for 2 hours, then you're probably in a good position to do a 10-week block for marathon training. But that can vary a great deal. If this is your first marathon, then that period probably needs to be longer with a more steady build-up. Whereas in, you know, your case, you know, you could probably at this point that you're not training for a marathon, but, you know, give us 6 weeks and you could probably get yourself in pretty good shape because of the training you've done over the last 18 months. So I think it does vary a fair bit. And I know that, you know, you guys in the podcast at times talk about your marathon preparations being too long. And I think for you guys, that's very real. You know, you're always in pretty good shape. So it's really just a matter of honing those sessions and that volume to get it marathon specific, but that's not necessarily the case for most of us punters that are out there, you know, slogging away. And I think that a longer preparation is often sensible for a lot of people.
And you've been in this game for quite a while, and I'd like to get your views on the traditional way of training for a marathon, like the guys at Mona and Deke did, where they weren't running, I guess, marathon paces for long periods of time in training, where over what, the last probably 5 years, there's been a big shift in doing, you know, close to 25-30K close to marathon pace in training. What are your thoughts on that?
That's like a loaded question.
because like, I guess with training talk for us, we speak to guys like Mona and we say, why did you guys do the training that you did? Because how is that specific to a marathon in terms of, yes, they're out there running for 2.5 hours every Sunday, but not nowhere near marathon pace. And then all of their sessions were like 20 to 30 minutes. So how is that specific to running, you know, 2 hours at marathon pace? So I'd love to just hear your thoughts coming from a sports science background.
Yeah, look, a little bit of it crosses over with what I said a moment ago, which is everyone's an individual, right? And, you know, you might get someone that's the opposite to you who's got no speed and a lot of strength. And that approach is going to work better for them than it might for you. Yeah. Whereas, you know, for you, if you went and did that approach, then you'd probably continue to enhance your speed and not have the strength you need for a marathon. But for someone that's doing that might work well. So it's not something that I'm specifically opposed to, but it's also not the approach I would generally take. You know, for me, the experience is that most of the runners I've worked with need more strength to get through a good marathon than speed. But, you know, if you look at someone who has a big training age and, you know, has always done large volumes since they were young, then, you know, they can probably focus more on speed because of that background in strength they're going to sustain.
Yeah.
But I think it's also more than that, Croaks. I think it's, you know, we all sit there and go, oh, this is the key to getting a good marathon. You just do these sessions.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the body and, you know, you as an individual don't just go through, you know, those 7 to 10 training sessions a week. You know, you go through a job, you have sleep, you have all of these other commitments. And I think all of those things start having just as much of an impact as the training itself. And I think all of us could say that we've been at our fittest when we've trained consistently. And it's almost secondary what the actual sessions were that you did during that time. So I think there's so many considerations that it's really difficult to say, you know, this is what you need to do to get the best outcome.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point in that knowing all the stresses an athlete has outside of their actual training, because you could set training, but if they're not able to do it through work commitments and things like that, or the training's too hard for how much time they have and all the other stress, then obviously it's not going to be an efficient, like a productive program, is it?
No, and I guess that's, you know, to make that an example very close to home, it's exactly what you're experiencing at the moment, right? That, you know, prior to BWA, you were coming off school holidays and therefore you're effectively a full-time athlete. And then, you know, you transition back into full-time work, and can you continue to do that same load? Well, it's definitely a lot harder because you're off working a full-time job and you've got all of these other commitments. And I think that it's worth taking that into account, because it means that, you know, the 180K big weeks when you're, you know, that semi-full-time athlete are probably not going to, or not always going to be the best outcome when you're working full-time. And maybe that's 160K. But once again, that's different for everyone as well. You know, and if you're transitioning into, say, a new job, then that's extra stress over someone who's been doing the same job for 10 years and, you know, they're quite comfortable with it mentally and physically. It's, you know, it's less of a stress for them than someone who's just being exposed to it, you know, recently.
Yep.
So I think it's just individual. There's no right or wrong.
Yeah. All right. Now I'm going to list, because I know that we have some good discussions about training, and me always wanting to do maybe a little bit more, and you're always saying, no, why don't you just do this instead? So I'm going to use a couple of examples, and maybe you can tell me why you suggest doing this instead of what I would like, or what, not what I want to do, but what I guess I would see most people do. So the first example is, I regularly do a 5x1K session off 90 seconds. And like I remember doing 5x1Ks when I was a 1500 meter runner. So why do you set me 5x1K instead of 6 or 8, which is, I guess, probably more common for, especially for a marathoner?
Yeah. Look, there's never any right and wrong, right? So this is my opinion,
and that's exactly what we want. We just want what's your thinking behind it? And look, it's working, so I don't want to change it. But
So I think there's two things. Is the one thing that you're coming from a background where you've got a good amount of speed, and I don't think it's the speed that's going to be the limitation for your marathon outcome, but we want to make sure that you also don't lose that. So it's just doing these top-up sessions so that you're running at speed, but the sessions aren't killer sessions. And, you know, you can go and do your 5x1K, you hit that higher speed, you get the benefit associated with it, but the next day you're back up and you can still get out there and do your midweek long run. And that 5x1K hasn't had these big fatiguing impacts to the same effect that, say, 8x1K might. Because I guess once you get to 8x1K, it starts having a far more, you know, endurance aspect, and therefore the fatigue coming out the back end of that and the damage coming out of that is much greater. Which once again would be fine for some people, but in your case, I guess what we've found that works is it's like doing all these little top-ups. So if we look at your training for BWA, there was no sessions that were these huge sessions that were like, okay, these were the big ones. You know, there was definitely bigger ones, but overall it was just very consistent and hitting a session and then later in the week hitting another session and just week in, week out and grinding that away. And I think that's the reason in your case that 5x1Ks is the best option. Once again, if someone was really needing to be able to try and sustain speed, you know, and it's not a pure speed session, 8x1K, right, because of the length of it, but there's sort of like a strength endurance aspect to it as well, then, you know, someone needing to sustain a high speed for the marathon, then longer stuff might work.
Yeah. Okay, next one is now that I'm a marathoner, I regularly want to go out and hit 2-hour 30 long runs because, you know, that's what guys like Deke and Mona did, like week in, week out, 2.5 hours. But regularly, you'll pretty much fluctuate my long runs. One week I'll have 30K, another week I'll have 34, then back to 32. So why the varying long run distances as opposed to just why not get out there and run 2.5 hours every Sunday?
Yeah, I think there's a few parts to that answer. The first one is when you're in marathon training, then mentally 2.5 hours doesn't seem that long. But, you know, if we all think back to the time that we weren't in marathon training and we were, you know, just doing 20K long runs, then 2.5 hours seems like an eternity, right? So yeah. Even though the body is better prepared for it now, it's still a big demand and it's a big load on the body. So, you know, doing that week in and week out, you know, can definitely be a greater risk. But I think there's the reason for varying it is not just that. It's also that training monotony, you know, being the same type of thing week in and week out is one of the biggest causes of injury. So, you know, being able to vary that training moves away from or reduces injury risk because you're varying the type of load. But I think the main reason I actually like to do it is also the mental aspect that, you know, doing the same thing week in and week out becomes less motivating and it's harder to get out there and enjoy it. So variety, you know, even for us boring runners, is the spice of life. So, you know, by you doing a 2-hour run, you know, once every 3 or 4 weeks, then, you know, suddenly then that makes the 2-hour, 2.5-hour runs, you're up a little bit more for them mentally. Whereas if you're doing them week in and week out, they can become a drain pretty quick.
Yeah, and I think the answer will be similar for this next one. I've mentioned on the podcast that we generally work on a 4-week cycle, but it's not your traditional one where you have either 3 weeks that gradually get higher in volume followed by a recovery week, or 3 consistent hard weeks followed by a recovery week. We sort of have, and I'll just put some examples of maybe kilometers, would have our high week of say 190, then a recovery week of 140, back up to 175, and then back down to say 160 odd. So you're actually never increasing on the week that you've previously done. And so, yeah, I haven't seen a lot of programs like that before. So what's your thinking behind that?
Yeah, I guess that I've been using that for a long time because it gets that variety. You know, in a 1 month block, you can hit 2 pretty hard weeks with reduced injury risk because you're coming off a slightly easier week. Mm. So, you know, it's just being able to go in steps. You know, it's up, big down, instead of just build, and then bringing it down. And, you know, it's, I think earlier this year, we tried a 3-week cycle where we went sort of, you know, moderate, hard recovery and then going through that cycle. And you didn't like that as much. Mm. And I think that there's a physical aspect to that 4-week cycle that you mentioned. But I think one of the reasons you kept mentioning you personally liked it prior to BWA, or maybe Berlin, is because of the mental aspect as well, right? In that, you know, you focus heavy for a 190 week and then you get a bit of that mental relaxation the next one and then you can pick yourself up and go for a 175 in the next big week. And, you know, so instead of having to be always on, you know, both mentally and physically, you're getting that downtime.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I guess I'm of the opinion that, especially for marathon runners, you've only got so many cookies to spend each year, both physically and mentally. And, you know, you start spending them at times you don't need them, then you've wasted them. So, you know, just trying to spread them out a bit and replenish them by giving yourself that bit of a freshen up.
Yeah, I think what I said to you was what I like about it. So the traditional way might have been do 160, 170, 180, then recovery. And the times that I've done that in the past, I've got to the 170 week and I've been pretty cooked and I then have to up it again. So yeah, you do have that mental break and physical break by never having to, you know, go higher than what you've just gone. So
And I think one of the biggest indicators of injury risk is also that mental aspect of motivation. You know, generally they're pretty well tied together, that, you know, when motivation's struggling, then that means the body's fatigued and the injury risk is higher. So it's not as though all of these things are unrelated. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's like we said before, having that easier week gives the, you know, mental freshen up, but in turn, you know, the body freshens up as well.
Yeah, and Julian and I had a chat during the week as an extra release for patrons, and about two sessions a week versus three. And so many runners out there, just through tradition, have always gone, need to do sessions Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. Even if you've done a race on like the Saturday or the Sunday, Tuesday rolls around, it's like, well, it's a session day, I need to do a session. We only do really two quality sessions a week. You know, sometimes a long run can be classed as a third. Your thoughts on why you do two instead of three, or do you think two sessions is better than three?
Well, I think it works for you because you're old, Crooks.
That's true.
I think it works well for marathon runners because, you know, the Wednesday or the midweek long run and then the weekend long run are then allowed to have a greater emphasis, as opposed to focusing all on the intensity in those other three sessions. So, you know, I definitely find that's a way to go for marathon runners. Whereas if, you know, if you were aiming for a 5K, the overall load on that Wednesday and Sunday longer stuff would be reduced, and therefore you could probably hit three better sessions on a Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, you know, the traditional approach. Yeah. So I think it's a bit of horses for courses. But, yeah, generally the things that I find it works best for is, you know, marathon, and definitely for the older athlete who probably doesn't recover like they once did. Yeah. But I think you guys have discussed on the podcast before, right, whereas the three sessions a week's the very Australian model where, you know, a lot of the approaches in America is just the two sessions a week.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Well, we've pretty much covered off everything. I guess maybe one last question is, as a coach, what pisses you off the most when you see an athlete that you coach? Is there anything that pisses you off in particular if they do something, like whether it be, I don't know, run too fast on easy days or do an extra rep? Is there something that really gets under your skin?
Is this the list of why Crooks annoys me?
I don't know.
I think there was a time before BWA. I was trying to remember before what it actually was, but maybe it was 3 or 4 weeks before BWA where you went and did something stupid. And it was like, oh, you know, what the hell's he doing? He's in good shape. The only reason he's doing this is to convince himself he's in good shape.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think those things, I guess they don't really piss me off, but they're a learning thing as well, right? Is that the one thing I've learned over the last 12 months is how important it is for runners to be confident, you know, to prove to themselves that they can do something. I think there's just simple rules that it's really easy to break. And, you know, like I can sit here and, you know, you're asking me questions as though I'm some authority, but at the same time, you know, last week I went and did a interval session 48 hour after a big day, and I felt terrible. And I look back to, you know, a couple of years ago when one of our mutual mates did that and got injured, and we all sat around telling him he was an idiot and why the hell would you do that? So yeah. I think it's always easy in retrospect to look at a whole range of things and be frustrated by it. But yeah, I guess my pet peeve probably, Crooks, is people who don't pace things well. You know, whether it be, you know, just going to the park run or whether it be, you know, in a marathon, there's always those people that seem to go out a whole lot quicker than they've got any chance of sustaining and then have a very miserable back end. And that's something that's very easy to avoid just with a bit of common sense, I think.
Yeah. And so does that annoy you because you know often how hard people have trained for it and they've sort of just gone out and ruined an opportunity?
I guess it annoys me because it's just a mental mistake that you can just, if you have a level of planning, then you can, you know, just work around it, right? Mm. It's You know, for example, if my marathon PB is 2:50, then I probably shouldn't go out in the first half in 80 minutes.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and it, I guess it scales to all levels. It's the same when you rock up to the local 5K or 10K fun run and you see those people that are going great guns halfway through and then they lose 2 minutes in the second half of a 10K. And I think it's just a pure execution issue. So, you know, as you said, you spend all of that time trying to prepare and then it's so easy to lose it just because you get carried away.
Yeah. Can you, before we go, can you remind me of that? I remember it would have been in one of our discussions where I wanted to do more and you were cutting it back, and it was something that was said at the Swans about, like, guys like Adam Goods, something about, you know, they're better being on the field at 80% than not there at all, or something like that. Do you remember saying that to me?
Yeah. They always had a philosophy that, you know, that take their best player, you know, say an Adam Goods, and they'd rather him on the field at, you know, 80% fit and uninjured, than, you know, trying to push him to get 100% fit and having this much greater risk of injury, and then he's off the field and they're going down to that lower level player.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, obviously that exact same analogy doesn't apply, but, you know, before this discussion, you know, you and I were talking your own training and saying, well, let's up the volume. And it's like, well, things are going well, you know, well, why? You know, we can have things continue to go well. We don't need to push right to the red line when we're already getting the improvements we want, you know, a little bit below that. So I think sometimes just playing it a little bit safer is a sensible option. But look, it's easier said than done. When it's yourself, you're always trying to do more, and that's the problem with runners, is they are self-motivated and often overly so.
Yeah, all right. So before we wrap up, and we will wrap up this time, you coach yourself, don't you?
Yes.
So how do you find, because you're a runner like the rest of us, you probably want to do more, or so how do you go coaching yourself so you don't fall into those traps? Or do you feel like you do fall into those traps and you should probably have a coach? So, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, do you think people can coach themselves effectively?
They have to have some real heavy self-control and be better than me at it. You know, as you know, that, you know, you and the other boys will give me a bit of a stick when I do something stupid because it's something that I tell you guys not to do.
Yeah.
So it's far easier to give someone else advice when you have this unbiased view than when it's you, and you know, you are making decisions a bit from an emotional point of view. So, you know, I think it can be done, but I think it's far harder. So, you know, it's something that generally for an elite athlete, it's something I'd recommend that they don't do, because, you know, even if it's, you know, the same as in your case, that you could probably come to the same point in the training that, you know, you and I have got to jointly most of the time, but sometimes it's just that sort of bird on the shoulder sort of giving you a bit of a, I guess, unbiased advice that might keep you in the right spot at that time.
Yeah, very true, and I really appreciate it. So, yeah, thanks for your time tonight. All the best with Christchurch in 2 weeks. Don't do anything stupid between now and then. And, yeah, where can people follow you? I know you're not really into social media, but you're on Strava and things like that?
I am on Strava, Ben Wisby on Strava. But that's about all. I don't do Facebook and I don't post anything on Twitter. So, yeah, I'm pretty unsocial in general, Croaks, like any good runner.
Yeah, nice. All right, listeners, so if you want to see what Ben's up to, then just add him on Strava. So, yeah, cheers, Ben. And as I said, good luck for Christchurch.
Thanks. See you there.